Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to welcome back to the Solari Report, really an outstanding attorney and scholar, Edwin Vieira Jr. I forgive him his 4 degrees from Harvard. It's very rare. I seek out people who graduated from Harvard Law School, but it just goes to show you that great scholarship can come from Harvard. He's been practicing law for more than 30 years with an emphasis on constitutional issues, and he is really the person I first go to see what's happening on any constitutional issue. You can find his articles at edwinvieira.com. He, in the Supreme Court of the United States, he has successfully argued or briefed several cases, including those which establish the constitutional and statutory limitations on the uses to which labor unions in both the private and public sector may apply fees extracted from non-union members. So this is a man who has both practiced and shown incredible scholarship. He has an extraordinary number of excellent books he's written. Two of my favorites are Pieces of Eight, The Monetary Powers and Disabilities of the United States Constitution, and it's a real history of or legal history of the legal aspects of the monetary history in the United States. Absolutely fascinating. Another is The Sword and Sovereignty, The Constitutional Principles of the Militia of the Several States. And we had him, when that was published on the Solari Report, to talk about the powers and of the militia under the Constitution. But he has many other books, one highlighted on his website, How to Dethrone the Imperial Judiciary. And I'm sure that's going to come up in today's conversation. But I strongly recommend you, particularly if you're interested in constitutional issues, that you reach out and check out his articles and website and books. They're all excellent sources. So, Dr. Vieira, welcome to the Solari Report.
Yeah, my pleasure being with you.
Okay, so we're going to talk. Everyone in the Solari Report has heard me beat the drum of constitutional amendments and conventions are a terrible idea. We need to enforce the Constitution, not change it. And if we're not going to enforce it, then we don't need to change it. But it's time to get into the details because clearly there's something afoot. So start us off and explain, under the Constitution, what are amendments, what are conventions, how can they happen, and sort of what does the Constitution say about amending the Constitution?
Well, Article 5 of the Constitution provides two basic methods for amendment. First, if 2/3 of both houses of Congress agree, then Congress can propose amendments to the Constitution, and those would go out for ratification by the states. Or, if 2/3 of the states apply to Congress, then Congress shall call a convention for proposing amendments. And those amendments, whatever came out of that convention, would go out to the states. And the ratification process in both situations would be by the legislatures of 3/4 of the states, or by conventions that were called in 3/4 of the states, depending on which mode of ratification might be proposed by Congress. So you have those two routes. The first one, going through Congress to seek an amendment, is the one that has generally been followed through the history of the United States. Because the Constitution was originally proposed by a convention called from the original 13 states. So that was the only time we had a constitutional convention. And then afterwards, the amendments have been proposed through Congress. What is being proposed now by a number of people from different ends of the political spectrum is a convention which would deal with the amendment process, and it depends on to whom you talk exactly what amendments would be proposed or how far that convention would be seen as being allowed to go. Now, all of this comes back, at least in the presentations by the proponents of the convention, to the question that the Constitution has been, let's say, misinterpreted over the years. And as a result, the powers of the government in Washington, D.C. have been expanded, perhaps improperly, most of the critics say improperly. And therefore, amendments of the Constitution are necessary to constrain the government of Washington, D.C. The big focus in this area has been from the beginning on what's called in general balanced budget amendment, an amendment that somehow would require fiscal responsibility, accountability, whatever word you want to use, to Congress so that we couldn't have the continuation of these massive and potentially unfundable deficits that have been generated over the years. So that was the initial call for the Constitutional Convention, the initial rationale. And then as the idea began to catch on, people came forward with other amendments that they suggested would be necessary. Now, what's interesting about all of this is it really goes back not to the Constitution itself. Very few of these people point out a specific flaw in the original Constitution or the amendments that have been passed subsequently to the adoption of the Constitution. Their argument usually boils down to some interpretation that has been given to the Constitution by the Supreme Court that has overly expanded the powers of Congress, or perhaps in some instances the powers of the executive. They never talk too much about the powers of the courts, actually. And that this has to be corrected through a constitutional amendment because, according to the theory of judicial supremacy to which all these people seem to subscribe, a decision by the Supreme Court on an interpretation of the Constitution, no matter how wrong it may appear to everyone else in the world, is somehow binding on everyone in the world and can be corrected only by a subsequent decision of the Supreme Court, which would reverse its earlier decision, or by an amendment, essentially overruling that decision of the Supreme Court. So that's really the background. Now, if you look at this from what I would call a logical perspective, not getting into the details of the law specifically, it seems to me there are some anomalies here because, number one, for a constitutional convention to be called, the legislatures of the states have to apply to Congress. Well, if you're going to apply to Congress for a constitutional convention, why can't you apply to Congress for specific amendments? I mean, Congress is given the authority to propose specific amendments to the Constitution, and those would certainly be suggested by members of Congress, and the members of Congress represent in some way, whether they're a representative or a senator, people from the several states. So it doesn't seem as the convention is the logical way to go about this problem. And then secondly, as far as a convention is concerned, well, we've had no experience of what this might be like other than the first one that was held in 1787. And therefore, there's a tremendous amount of, let me call it controversy, because people are unsure as to precisely what process would be followed and what might come out of this kind of a convention. So that's opening up a completely new can of worms. We understand what happens when people ask Congress to propose amendments or suggest to Congress how to propose amendments. We just have had no experience with a convention. And the interesting thing to my mind about the convention route, in light of the argument that's made, well, we need to amend the Constitution because the Supreme Court has made all these mistakes over the years. If people dispute at some stage various aspects of the call of the convention or the procedures of the convention or how the amendments come out of this convention for ratification by the states, where will those controversies be settled? Well, they'll have to take them into the court system. So, we'd be running around in a circle here. If the real problem is that the courts have misinterpreted the Constitution, how can you rely upon the courts to correctly interpret that part of the Constitution that calls for a convention of the states? It leaves me sort of cold as to understanding the reasoning there. So that's the background. What we have now is not simply a call for a constitutional convention that would deal with a balanced budget amendment, or perhaps more than one amendment that would cover various aspects of the fiscal policy of the government, but it's become open-ended, and all sorts of people are proposing all sorts of amendments. And lurking in the background is the possibility that a convention called today would do essentially what the original convention did in 1787. Remember, The United States was organized on the basis of the Articles of Confederation before the Constitution was thought of. So the Articles of Confederation were a kind of constitution because they provided for certain powers for the Continental Congress and limitations on its powers and reserve powers for the states and so forth and so on. The same type of structure that we see in the Constitution. And people were dissatisfied with the Articles of Confederation primarily because they didn't want to have commercial tariff-type barriers between the states. They wanted to have essentially an open economy. And they didn't think that there was sufficient authority for the Continental Congress to make sure that that would happen. So the Continental Congress approved this convention, which was held in 1787, for the purpose of amending the Articles of Confederation. So it had a limited purpose, similar to what the argument is today for this Convention of the States, for the purpose of amending the Constitution that we now have. Well, what actually happened? The delegates to the Constitutional Convention met in secret, and they decided that the Articles of Confederation needed essentially to be set aside, not simply amended. And they proposed an entirely new constitution and sent this out to the states with a form of ratification that was different from the Articles of Confederation. The Articles of Confederation could not be changed without the unanimous consent of the legislatures of the states. That was Article 13. So they had a very strict amendment procedure built into the Articles of Confederation. When the new constitution was proposed, the final article said that the ratification of the conventions of only 9 states, not the 13 total, but only 9, would be sufficient for the establishment of the new constitution among the states that were ratifying it. And that was an interesting way of essentially forcing the other 4 states into compliance, because where would those other states be if 9 states had adopted a new constitution? The other 4 states, what, are going to be operating still under the Articles of Confederation? You would have had all sorts of confusion. And what really happened was Rhode Island was the holdout state. It was the final one that adopted the Constitution, and it found itself in that really anomalous position. How could it continue as a kind of a mini-republic when all the other 12 original states were operating under the U.S. Constitution? So if we look at the parallel, historical parallel here, it is certainly possible that coming out of a new convention of the states, we would have proposed an absolutely new constitution. And it could have a new form of ratification. It might not have to be ratified by 3/4 of the present states, maybe by half of the states, or maybe only 2/3 of the states, whatever that new constitution would propose. Now, a lot of people say, well, this is impossible because the convention would be called for the purpose of amending the Constitution as we now have it. To which I say, well, that was the purpose that was given when the original Constitutional Convention was proposed, and look what happened. But if you go back and look at this from a strictly legalistic point of view, you take the Constitution and there's the preamble, we the people for the purpose of forming a more perfect union and establishing justice and so forth and so on. And then following that introduction, there are the various articles of the Constitution that lay out the powers of Congress and the executive and the judiciary and so forth and so on. So they could amend the Constitution by simply saying, well, we're striking out everything that follows the preamble, and we're adding all of this new verbiage.
Right.
That would be an amendment.
Right.
You see that happening all the time with statutes. The statute's proposed by somebody, and they come along and say, oh, well, we don't want that. We're going to strike out everything that you've put after Section 1 and put an entirely new set of provisions in there, and that's an amendment to the statute that you originally, the bill that you originally proposed. So if we look at it from that point of view, this idea that somehow a constitutional convention called to amend the Constitution could not propose one way or the other an entirely new constitution is simply false.
Right. Right.
And if somebody didn't like that and said, wait a minute, this constitutional convention has proposed something that was outside of its authority, where would they go to have that question settled?
Right.
Well, they'd go to the judicial system, which they already say is the problem.
Right.
Right? You see how this is a circular, illogical process that they're talking about.
I told you about the time, I think, when I was in litigating with the federal government, and we were arguing jurisdiction, and In fact, if you look at the law, we had not only the law, but a recent Supreme Court case that agreed with us. And my attorney got very upset, and he said to the judge, who was the former general counsel of the CIA, he said, "But Your Honor, you know, that's the law, and we have a Supreme Court case that is recent on this point." And the judge said, "Well, you know something? I disagree with the law, so if you have a problem with that, take it up with Congress."
Yeah, I have seen that, too, in various situations, state courts as well as federal courts. That's right. Well, why? Because right. They can act as little tyrants. If you don't like their decision, well, you go appeal. You know, spend another 4 or 5 years and $100,000 grinding the judicial wheels at the various higher levels. And in many instances, you don't really get to the higher levels because the Supreme Court takes a very small number of cases. So the lower court, especially if this is happening, if it's an appeals court that's telling you this, then you really tend to be stuck in 99% of the cases because the Supreme Court's docket is very limited. They take only a very few.
I just want to step back a little bit in history. Could you remind everyone what the amendments to the Constitution have been since the founding of the Republic?
Well, we've had a number of them. If you think of the most famous ones, there was, of course, the Bill of Rights. First Amendment, Second Amendment, through the Tenth Amendment. Right? I guess most people don't really think of them so much as amendments as this complex called the Bill of Rights, but they came in as amendments. Then the 11th Amendment, which controlled the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court with respect to suits that were brought against the states by individuals. And you get up to famous ones coming out of the Civil War, 13th Amendment, outlawing slavery and involuntary servitude, except where an individual has been convicted of a crime. 14th Amendment dealt with citizenship, dealt with so-called privileges and immunities, due process and equal protection, all as applied to the states. 15th Amendment, voting rights. 16th, 17th, 18th amendments, and of course there's the women's voting rights for people 18 years of age. Amendments passed with respect to presidential succession. 25th Amendment is one that they're being talked about now, where a president could be declared to be incompetent for one reason or another. Maybe he has a mental problem or something else happened to him, an accident or whatever, and Congress could declare him to be incompetent.
The press is driving him crazy.
Yeah, they're suggesting it's about Mr. Trump, and Mr. Trump may be mentally ill or something, and he should be removed under the 25th Amendment.
Right.
Of course, you had the famous amendment that limited the terms of the presidency to two because Mr. Roosevelt had four, right? So
right.
they had to limit that problem. So that's what we've had. Some of them have been procedural, as the limitation of the presidential term or the removal of the president for some kind of an inability to perform his functions. Some of them have been very substantive, 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments, 16th Amendment. Income tax amendment.
When was the last?
Oh, my gosh. Well, the last one that they've attempted to do was, of course, the Equal Rights Amendment.
Right.
Which most people are familiar with. That went on for a very long time in the ratification process and was never ratified.
But when was the last time they did one that got ratified? Quite a while ago.
Yeah, I think that was what? Was that the 26th one with the 18 years of age voting?
I don't remember.
May have been. Well, in any event, it's some time ago, back in the last century, right? We can put it that way, back in the last century. We've been a while without amendments.
Right.
What's interesting, though, is we haven't been a while without knowing the normal amendment process. I mean, that's been done over and over and over again, right? Congress proposes an amendment and sends it out to the states, and three-quarters of the states have to ratify it by either their legislatures or by state conventions, depending on how Congress has set the ratification process up. So that's not something that we are unfamiliar with in terms of the process. And in a sense, the beauty of that process is we know specifically in each instance what this amendment is and what it's going to do. Right? That's
right.
The thing that's debated in Congress. They argue back and forth. They come up with some final language, and then they send it out. And it's done by Congress through the normal process by people who have been elected to the House of Representatives or the Senate by the normal process and therefore leaving vote fraud aside, at least in principle, are representative of the individuals who voted for them. Whereas the convention process is something that is essentially unknown because it comes back to this, I won't say mysterious word, because I don't think it is mysterious, but some people seem to be confused by it. In Article 5, on the application of the legislatures of two-thirds of the several states, Congress shall call a convention for proposing amendments. Now, that duty is as well a power. Congress has this power to do a thing called call a convention when a particular condition obtains, which is legislatures of the states have asked for it. Right. Well, when you call a convention, you have to specify. There'll be a convention that will be held from such and such a date and onward, or maybe indefinitely. Here's how people will be appointed as delegates. Perhaps here's the set of rules that will be at least initially used. Robert Rules of Order will be the ones used until the convention meets, and then the convention could decide its own. You might specify in a call what the amendments would be. A lot of the proponents of this are saying, oh, that's what has to happen. If the states say, we want this amendment and this amendment and this amendment, then Congress's call has to include only those amendments. Other people say, oh, no, Congress could have a call saying those proposed amendments plus any other amendments that the convention wished to consider. Or Congress could simply say, we're calling a convention and it will be open to whatever the delegates propose. Right? Nobody knows precisely how that term call would be interpreted. So it leaves to Congress potentially a great deal of leeway or control over the situation, especially, I would think, in the methodology for the selection of delegates. Right. And we have to remember the first constitutional convention back in 1787, who was there? Madison, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, George Mason. You think of the list of people. And these were all the great patriots in American history, the so-called founding fathers. They didn't always necessarily agree with each other, but they were people who were great students of political history and political science, and they certainly knew the laws of England because, of course, the American colonies had been English possessions, or part of the English and British Empire, and the laws, of course, of colonial America. They were well-versed in all of that, and they had just fought a war of independence because of the difference between the British Constitution, so-called, and what eventually became the Constitution of the United States. So this was a star-studded, a galaxy, if you will, of great minds from a practical political point of view. Now, would a James Madison and George Washington and Alexander Hamilton likely be called today as delegates to a new constitutional convention? I would think it would be more likely that it might be Charles Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. And now you come up with your own list of people. Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, who knows? These would be the people who would be called because they are the political luminaries. I wouldn't call them stars, but they're certainly in the spotlight today. And I would think that a congressional call for a convention would be rigged in such a way that establishment figures would be the ones who would be called as the delegates. I can't imagine you or I would be selected as delegates.
Let me step back and walk you through two things that feed into my concern. So if we look at the reasons that people say things are wrong, one is judiciary overreach. But there's another, and that is, if you look at the finances, on the overt side, yes, we've run up big deficits, but if you look at the amount of money missing and the violations of financial management, both envisioned in the Constitution and in the financial management laws, the government is breaking the law, and Congress is breaking the law daily when it comes to financial management, including the Constitution. And so there has been, and I would say many, many of the problems, including leading to the deficit, is that refusal by the process to enforce the Constitution with respect to the requirement that spending has to be envisioned in appropriations approved by Congress. So this inability to enforce cannot be cannot be addressed by a balanced budget amendment. All it can do is protect the people who've stolen the money from financial accountability when the day, you know, when the debt, the Social Security, and entitlements come due.
Well, I don't think there's that problem of refusal of people to enforce the Constitution against their own mismanagement or their own criminal activity, which is what's going on here at one level or another, in what you're talking
about, right,
is going to be corrected by a new constitutional amendment that says, gosh, honest, gee whiz, we're really going to try to enforce the Constitution. I mean, theoretically, the Constitution is enforceable as a matter of simply the oath of office of all of these people under Article 6, right? Senators and representatives, members of the state legislatures, all executive and judicial officers of the United States and the several states, it goes on and on, shall be bound by oath or affirmation to support this Constitution. And the provision you're talking about is what, Article 1, Section 9, Clause 7, no money shall be drawn from the Treasury, but in consequences of appropriations and the regular statement and account of the receipts shall be published from time to time. So people who have taken this oath or affirmation to support the Constitution are duty-bound to make sure that these appropriations are the money is drawn from the Treasury pursuant to appropriations, and that there is a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures, which is published to the country, right?
Well, let me ask you a legal question. In the summer of 2000, I think it was 2000 or 2001, I went to meet with the chief of staff to Kit Bond, who was then head of the Appropriations Committee for the Treasury and 21 agencies that included HUD. And the year before, $59 billion had gone missing from HUD. This was the year when $59 billion went missing. And so I was there just on a bill collection. I was trying to get my company paid. And so the chief of staff was somebody I didn't know. I'd just been introduced to. And they said to me, what do you think is going on at HUD? And I said, I don't know. What do you think is going on? Cuomo and the Democrats, the Clinton administration, was still in charge. And they looked me dead in the eye and they said, HUD is being run as a criminal enterprise. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, I don't disagree. And now, HUD is run on a matrix structure, so you can't run HUD on a criminal enterprise unless the New York Fed member banks, the Treasury, and the Department of Justice intentionally run it that way, along with the defense contractors who run the payment and information systems. So all those folks have to intentionally run it as a criminal enterprise for it to be a criminal enterprise. Anyway, later that summer, that appropriations subcommittee or committee voted out a big increase in appropriations for the agency. Now, all of those, I'm assuming, the senator who ran it, was required by his oath to obey the Constitution. So he and everybody on that committee is violating the Constitution because money's flying out the door that's not envisioned in an appropriation. And they know it, clearly. So what is the law of that?
Well, there's the problem. There are certainly a number of statutes that cover that. I would think, in a way, the really general one is Title 18 of the United States Code 241-242. I and you and every other American citizen has a civil right under the Constitution, a constitutional right, not to see this kind of activity going on because it's looting us, right? It's directly taking our tax money and, or it's preventing us from getting certain kinds of benefits that we're entitled to get from the government, whatever. We're suffering financially and otherwise from this kind of activity. So there's a criminal statute that says if anyone does that under color of law and has an effect on someone in a state in the United States, then there's criminal liability. And there's one statute, 242, covers the individual, and then 241 covers conspiracies to do this, two or more individuals involved in that kind of criminal activity. So right there, I mean, if I were a prosecutor, I'd say, oh, no problem. I have a basis for bringing a criminal action. Just show me the behavior that violates these provisions of the Constitution, and we'll go forward with that to the grand jury. Then, of course, you have RICO, Racketeering Influence and Corrupt Organizations Act, which deals with the concept that an enterprise can be run through a pattern of racketeering activity, and there are plenty of cases going way back that say that they dealt primarily with state and local government offices, or maybe the governor. I think Mandel, the governor of Maryland was brought up on a RICO charge claiming that he was using the office of the governor of Maryland as a criminal enterprise. And that requires simply a proof that fraud has been involved, mail fraud, wire fraud. I mean, there are a number of other provisions as well. But I would imagine the situation that you're talking about, there'd be plenty of mail fraud and wire fraud that would be involved in all those transactions. So then you'd say, well, HUD is being run as an enterprise on the basis of, you know, a racketeering behavior, pattern of racketeering activity. So the statutes are all there. And then, of course, there are statutes dealing with defalcation of monies, public monies and so forth, falsifying public records. And on we go. All of that stuff is there. The question then arises, well, why aren't the prosecutors, that's the first level here, why aren't the prosecutors who have wind of this kind of activity conducting the appropriate investigations either through the in-house counsel in the various agencies or through the FBI, bringing this eventually to some federal grand jury in District of Columbia? Why is that not happening? And the conclusion one has to draw is, well, this network of criminal behavior goes beyond any one particular agency. It's endemic in the whole bloody shebang there in Washington, D.C.
Right. I once asked a congressman who was on both the budget and defense appropriations. I said, there's $3.3 trillion missing from the DOD in the last 2 years. And he said, yes, I know. And I said, well, what are you doing about it? And he looked at me shocked. And this is in the middle of a town hall meeting in front of 30-plus people. He said, nothing. There's nothing I can do. So I proceeded to send him at all of his offices a long letter of about, many, many ideas of all the different things he could do. But I think his response was basically saying, this is political. You know, there's no political constituency. It's what Jeb Bush once said. There's no political constituency for financial accountability. So if you look at the federal budget, everybody's getting, a piece of the pie of ignoring all this.
Well, that's right. It goes back to a fellow by the name of Manker Olson wrote a book many years ago, The Logical Question.
This is a great book.
Yeah, remember that book?
Go ahead.
What did he say? The benefit of our listeners, what did he say? In collective action, you can always organize a group if that group is going to receive large returns, profits, from its organization, right? Cost of organization is much less than the profits to be returned to that group through its activity. It's easy to organize such a group. The difficulty comes if you're trying to organize a group which has large expenses in organization, but it will receive only small, negligible returns. So the typical reformist political group may be very difficult to organize because there's a lot of costs in doing that, and especially because what are you doing? Well, we're reforming the laws, but we're not getting some great profit from that. Whereas the group that is organized in order to subvert the laws and to generate profits, it's easy to organize that kind of a group and to maintain it. And that works for the typical lobbying situation. Small number of companies are willing to spend a huge amount of money if they're going to get a huge amount of defense contracts back as the result of that lobbying expenditure. Whereas the average taxpayer who wants to reduce his burden of taxes, well, it's only a small amount of money that he's going to get reducing his tax load, but he's going to have to contribute a lot of money to that anti-tax or that tax reform group. So it's very difficult to get him to participate. And that's what we have. The government is attacked by these leeches who can organize themselves because the payoff from their activity is very large, and the average American cannot respond to this because his personal payoff is so small that it isn't worth his putting in the amount of effort or expense in participating in the reform movement.
Didn't Olson call it the warlord problem?
The which?
He had some reference to warlords.
Kind of the free rider, the free rider problem.
Free rider.
In a sense. Free rider problem. And I think it's obvious that you can see this with the people who are constitutionalists in principle. What do they gain individually from seeing various provisions of the Constitution in force? Well, it's a very small amount, financially speaking. Whereas the ones who want to see the Constitution subverted so that the government will be able to spend more money on whatever projects these people are profiting from. No problem organizing them.
So I wanted to bring
special interests is tied into that theory.
Right. So I wanted to bring up a second piece before we go on to what's happening now. And that is, if you, you know, when I left government, I said that, you know, we need citizens to have a way to do this themselves. In fact, in a way that makes us money. So I came up with the idea of doing place-based financial databases. You know, I told you the community wizard. And so everybody could just look at how the money worked and figure out how to re-engineer it in a way that was good for taxpayers, but made a lot of money for local real estate and businesses. And of course, the Department of Justice seized the databases and the software tools and took me many years and $6 million to get them out of court control. But what I discovered, you know, I got a real, advanced degree in covert operations targeting people, you know, who are trying to do good works. Now, if you look at how things like tort reform or Common Core have gone through the states, so you have big money like Gates or like the Koch brothers, and working through Alex, they spend a fortune and engineer basically dreadful stuff, you know, I'm sure some of them think it's good stuff. But if you look at the covert operations that are used, you know, the people get destroyed, they get targeted, there's violence. I mean, these people don't play within the law. So when you talk about getting something through ratification for through three-fourths of the state, that's one thing if you're running a clean process. But if you're running covert operations and you have billions or trillions behind it, it's a very different kettle of fish.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's dangerous enough if it were a clean process.
Right.
Because
I do, too.
You get the wrong people there as the delegates, and they'll come up, you know, they may believe in good faith, ideologically, in the changes that they want to propose, and I would look at those changes and say, well, they're the worst possible thing we could do, but at least the people are believing it in good faith. I think a lot of the proponents of this Constitutional Convention of the States are not acting in good faith. They really have
right.
a covert intent.
Yes.
And the most dangerous one of all is the group that intends to change the Constitution in a wholesale manner. Right.
Well, let me bring up a couple of reasons why they might want to change the Constitution in wholesale manner. I mean, if you look at, for many decades, we've made commitments as a country to the citizens, for example, Social Security or military pensions.
Right.
Or we've issued lots of debt to creditors, and we're liable for all those things. Now, we've gone through a period which I describe as a financial coup d'etat, where literally trillions have disappeared from the federal government. And, you know, we can argue that we don't really know how much that is because we don't have a proper accounting, and that's true. But we're clearly way outside the law, and a great deal has gone missing. And now that these other liabilities are coming due, you know, no one wants to be liable for them. The way you get out of being liable for them is if you can have, you know, if you can break up the United States because states start seceding, or you can have a constitutional convention and tear the thing up. What you can do is make sure they can never come and get the assets back, because the assets are still around in some place. So if you've robbed the bank, you want to make sure the bank gets shut down before somebody says, where's the money? You know, and you want to basically get out of the liabilities and be able to blame somebody. Well, it's not our fault. You know, all the states seceded way away. We didn't, you know. So to me, it's a, any kind of constitutional convention or change is basically a clever way of abrogating your contracts.
Oh, sure. And if you go back to the bank robbery analogy, fellow robs a bank, and then he has the political power to go to the legislature and change the law and make bank robbery no longer illegal with retroactive effect. So now he's covered himself. I mean,
right.
That's kind of an obvious way of doing it, but that's what you're talking
right.
about here. They'll make some changes in the Constitution, put in a new constitutional structure entirely, and then turn around and say, well, what happened under the old Constitution, we're not going to accept. And, you know, if you look at the Articles of Confederation to the change of the Constitution, the founders were very clear. In Article 6, they say, all debts contracted and engagement entered into before the adoption of this Constitution shall be as valid against the United States under this Constitution as under the Confederation, that is, the Articles of Confederation. They were trying to be honest about it. They had incurred
right.
a lot of debts under the Articles of Confederation fighting the War of Independence, And they were essentially saying, okay, all of those debts we're going to make good in some way, although they didn't exactly because they had to scale them down. But you're thinking of a proposal in this new constitution or in whatever amendments they propose that would be the opposite of Article 6, Clause 1, that would allow treat these earlier debts and engagements as somehow no longer viable.
Or there's another alternative, which is the debts are good, but you make provisions so that no one can come after. I mean, let's say you've stolen $50 trillion. You want to make sure when you balance the budget that $50 trillion is not on the table. It's like, oops, that's gone. And now we balance the budget, so all of you citizens, you're liable to provide all of this stuff so we can radically cut spending because we have to under the balanced budget, or you have to, you know, be taxed more and you have to be liable for this in a variety of ways. And if you're not, we get to do this, this, and this.
Right. Or under the balanced budget amendment, as you're creating this scenario, they could say, well, we have to cut back on the Social Security payments.
Right.
Think Social Security is some kind of a contract, and whoever it is, I'm entitled to this because I paid my money in, and I have a legal right to get some kind of payment back. And the short answer is, the Supreme Court already ruled that isn't true.
Right.
It's Fleming versus Nessa case. Supreme Court ruled that Social Security is a kind of welfare payment, notwithstanding that people paid in under the impression that this was some kind of a forced savings operation, and that if Congress wanted to cut off those payments, too bad for you. Gone.
Right.
So you could very well have a balanced budget amendment or set of amendments that would be the rationalization for coming back and saying, well, we have to cut people's Social Security by 50%.
Right.
Too bad
exactly.
for you. Supreme Court already ruled way back then, and we're just following on with this. And we now have the obligation under this new amendment to do that.
Yeah, it's the people wanted this, and it's not our fault, and we're just doing what the law says.
Our hands are tied. You gave us these new amendments, and we have to comply with them. My gosh, we believe in this new constitutional structure, and too bad for you, but we have to remove some significant amount of your payment. Or the other side of the coin, of course, is expand the tax base, expand the tax load on people who are working to pay. I would think they'd go the other way.
Right.
So, yes, you have all these possibilities. And the interesting thing is, you see, who is proposing these amendments? It's the big money folks. You mentioned the Koch brothers, as for instance, are behind this. What is their financial interest in this? Are these people simply, patriots? They're putting all of this money into this operation simply out of a concern for abstract legality, abstract legal principles?
So why wouldn't a patriot require that the current laws, the current constitution and the current financial management laws are enforced? I mean, the Supreme Court has not ruled, and the courts have not ruled against compliance with financial management laws and the provisions of the constitution related to spending, as far as I know. So if you're the Koch brothers, why aren't you spending your money in lobbying that that those laws be enforced? Because if the laws were enforced, it would solve a great deal of these problems.
Well, I think it's go back to Manker Olson, because they don't see any profit in that course of action. They see some profit in the amendments they think are going to be passed.
Right.
That's what makes me very nervous, because some people in good faith have put out these various balanced budget amendment proposals. You look at them and say, I don't think that's really going to work. But I don't see how the particular people who are proposing them stand to gain a huge amount of money if it were passed.
Here's how they make money. You put in a balanced budget proposal, and you do it in a way that the $50 trillion I've stolen is off the table. That's number one. But then number two, the federal, state, and local government own tremendously valuable assets. You force a process where they have to sell them, where the nature of that process is going to force them out for 10 cents on the dollar, and you get
like
to
Greece?
Pick them up. Yes.
You mean like
exactly.
Greece?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
The Greek proposal. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, sure. Well, and they already run that scenario.
Yeah, they ran it in Russia. They've tested it around the world.
Economic regime change.
Right. Right.
So
exactly.
All they need is a platform, a kind of constitutional platform on which to stand, And then they will turn the gears that they have already honed very well and lubricated very well in these other instances.
Okay, so here's the financial coup d'etat. The financial coup d'etat is you globalize. While you're globalizing, you bubble the housing market and some other markets. You suck a great deal of money out of the economy, including the, you know, $11 plus trillion dollars going missing. You do it with massive amounts of securities fraud, both government securities and particularly mortgage securities. When the bubble bursts, you get the taxpayers to basically refinance all the debt out and stick it on the taxpayers' balance sheet. And then you come along and say, I want to balance the budget. And the $50 trillion you've stolen is off the table. And now you balance the budget on the backs of the taxpayers. And you say, okay, well, we're going to privatize all the assets. And you do a fire sale and pick them up at 10 cents on the dollar with all the money you've stolen.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it works. So,
oh, yeah. Yeah, sure, yeah. Exactly. And the taxpayers end up with austerity, as they call it.
Right.
They're driven into third world living standards, second or third world living standards, and the 1%, the globalist oligarchs, walk off with all the property.
Right. Now, if you look at the biggest compromise of internal financial controls during the beginning part of the financial coup d'etat, the reason nobody noticed that all that money was disappearing from the federal government, I'll go back and tell you the story. In the spring of 1997, I was meeting with a group of top pension fund leaders in the country, including the head of CalPERS. And he said to me, you don't understand, it's too late. They've given up on the country. They're moving all the money out starting in the fall, which was the beginning of, it was October 97, the beginning of the 1998 fiscal year when all the money started going missing from the federal government. Big, big money. And in fact, what happened, no one noticed as the money started to go missing. And I was jumping up and down and screaming about all the different things that were happening. It was a real bust through in internal financial controls in the federal government. No one noticed. You know why? Because they were talking about Monica Lewinsky.
Mm-hmm.
Monica Lewinsky was the air cover. And if you look at a lot of what's going on in Washington around the press versus Trump, it looks like Monica Lewinsky, too. And that's why I'm so concerned about the Constitutional Convention, because I think we're looking at the big third leg of that financial coup d'etat.
Well, that's what eventually they would need. They would need the legal coloration to justify what they have done,
right,
and to rationalize the looting that they plan to do.
Right.
And they really can't find it under the present Constitution. Or at least if they attempted it under the present Constitution, at some stage someone might come back and say, wait a minute, we need to investigate this from the, you know, the RICO point of view.
Well, but they did try. They tried to get Jeb or Hillary, because remember, the Bushes and the Clintons have led this all along. So they tried to get Jeb or Hillary made president, and now with the, you know, that not happening, this is their route.
Well, what do you think? Now we have Mr. Trump in there. What do you think of the prospects that anyone in the Trump administration is going to look at this from the perspective that we have been discussing?
Well, that's why I'm going to make this Salieri report public.
run the flag up the pole and see who salutes it, right? That kind of thing.
That's right. You know, I you know, one of the things that has really been heartwarming to me is the new administration comes in, and every time they start to get off course, I call them Titanic turners. You know, I've said to everybody, look, there are four profiles you need to understand in what's going on in Washington. We have the Titanic turners who are trying to turn the ship in time. We have piggies who are just trying to get a piratization going. You know, but if you can manage them right and say, look, the way you make money is helping the Titanic turners, you can get them to play along. So, you know, number one question, the administration, is Gary Cohen going to be a piggy or help the Titanic turners? And then you have the security cats who are just, you know, scared to death of everybody, don't want to play the game. And then you have scorpions who just, you know, it's all about power and grabbing power and being a toll booth and an obstacle, and they're just trouble. You got to keep the scorpions in the corner. And so when you see, you know, sort of Trump and his team getting getting downed by the scorpions and forgetting about what they came there to do. There was one week where Drudge and Steve Forbes and David Stockman all swarmed in and said, no, we can't wait on tax reform. This is why we voted you in. You have to focus on what's important. And you could see Trump was like, oh, you're right, you know, and he did a 180. So what's happening is the Titanic Turners are really swarming in and trying to help in a very positive way, and it's gratifying to see. So I'm ultimately the optimist, because here's the reality. If you pull off sort of the nuclear strike at the end of the financial coup d'etat with the Constitutional Convention, you know, these guys are scorpions. They're always going to drown the frog in the middle of the river, and they're going to drown with it. You're going to kill the goose that laid the golden egg, because you're talking about complete lawlessness. And, you know, I don't know where these folks think they're going to live. When, you know, because here's the thing, Edwin, just talking as a banker, you know, if the price earnings ratio of the S&P is 10 or 12, you know, with no law, it's 1. If you have law, it's 10 or 12. That's a lot of money. The price of lawlessness destroys values in an economy.
Well, they still may be able to convince themselves that they can keep the lid on.
Oh, I'm sure they can convince themselves they can keep the lid on, but I don't think they can this time. I think if you let them do what they really want to do, they will kill the goose that laid the golden egg. But I don't think they know that, which is why I think it's imperative that we not, you know, here's the thing. When a society allows the scorpions to take control, you know, that society's not going to last. So I just think the Titanic Turners have to really swarm in and help each other. And I think there are a lot of very, you know, I've never met someone who wanted a constitutional convention who wasn't really good-hearted. Now, you know, some people might describe them as intensely brainwashed, but there are an awful lot of people who don't understand the mechanisms to achieve enforcement of the things they want to see enforced. They really don't know the specifics of how to get what they want, and they go see Hamilton. Last year I went up to New York and saw Hamilton, and I'm a great, I love lots about Hamilton. He was a transparent kind of guy. Anyway, but you see Hamilton, you think, oh, Constitutional Convention, how wonderful. You know, let's all get in there, all us young people with great ideas, and reinvent our country. you can see the lies pouring out, you know. It's like, oh, this is going to be really bad.
Well, I think it's also true that I agree with you that a lot of people that I have run into who are in favor of this Constitutional Convention idea are extraordinarily naive.
Right.
They are. They're sick and tired of the present failure of the system to enforce its own rule of law. And they're desperately searching for some kind of panacea. And
right.
So they'll buy whatever snake oil, you know, the con man is offering to them.
Right.
And they haven't thought it through in any way, shape,
right,
or form. And they probably imagine it in terms of what happened the first time. Oh, we got
right.
this wonderful constitution, and, well, it wasn't as good as it could have been, but now we know that, and we know what the areas of controversy problems are, and so let's just do it again and correct those problems.
Right.
Not understanding that the people who are coming to this new constitutional convention will not have, let me say, the ideological mindset of the ones who came to the first one.
Right.
And there's your problem.
Right.
They came, in a sense, the Constitution was foreordained as a consequence of things that had happened before. There was
right.
the British Constitution. The U.S. Constitution is modeled to a great extent on the basic structure of the British Constitution. There was the Articles of Confederation. There was the experience that the various states had in forming their own state constitutions prior to the Constitution of the United States. And all of this, in a sense, conspired, if I may use that word, to result in a group of people with a certain perspective on political science and practical politics coming together and simply working out in the most pragmatic fashion possible a document that they thought would be most acceptable to a country made up of people who largely thought the way they did.
Right.
This wasn't a country divided 50-50 between Leninist right. progressives and constitutional conservatives, which we seem to have today. It was a country right. that was very much on the same plane ideologically and politically. Now, there were, you know, as always, economic conflict, class conflicts, if you will.
Right.
And they were trying to, as it were, finesse those in the U.S. Constitution. They did a pretty good job of it because it was ratified. You didn't have a split in the country between the slave states and the northern states or whatever kind of dichotomies you would have wanted to imagine. Now, today it's exactly the opposite. So one would imagine that if a constitutional convention, the delegates faithfully represented the split in the country, nothing would come out of that convention. Whereas if it reflected the so-called progressives, the leftists in this country, God knows what it would look like, the product of that convention. And I don't believe that that convention is going to be staffed with delegates who are constitutionalists in the sense in which I use that word,
right.
you use that word.
Right.
I would be willing to bet a stack of Kruger ants, you know, as tall as I am, those people would not be. There might be one or two of them there for coloration, right? But the
right.
other 200
right.
would be right. the Charles Schumer's, Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah, but those two would have a huge control file.
Oh, yeah. Well,
yeah,
is Congress going to set up a call that will not draw people from the establishment into the Constitutional Convention?
No, they're gonna have people from the establishment, that's for sure.
Of course.
Let me just mention one thing. One of my favorite things, there used to be a former city councilman in Philadelphia whose name was Ed Schwartz, and he had a group that I loved. I was on the listserv called the Institute for Civic Values. And one of the things he would make people do is take the Constitution, read it, and all the neighbors would read it, and then sit down and go through it and say, okay, what does this say about how we should run this neighborhood? And basically get them to try and reinvent the application of the Constitution for their, basically, their neighborhood or their county or their, you know, sort of local area. And it was a remarkably edifying process. And certainly informed many of the things they could clean up locally. And I always tell people, you know, on enforcement, if you want to enforce, the corruption starts, you know, one county at a time for 3,100 counties. It's the power flows bottom up. So, you know, clean up your county and you will be doing a noble process to cleaning up the whole thing. But it's for...
And a lot easier to control as possible.
Absolutely.
At the local level.
Well, Edwin, I just have to tell you, this has been a remarkable... Every conversation with you is a remarkable conversation, but as I said, we're going to make this public because I really do hope it gets to everybody who needs to hear it, including the team in the administration, because I just told someone, stop sending more names to those people, help them do what they want instead of trying to push more people in, they're too busy, but I think you're an exception to that rule.
I hope they
reach out. Anything before we go, could you just go through with us again your website and books and how we plug into your work and get access to your wonderful work?
Well, you can find most of my stuff on edwinviera.com and books, CDs. There's actually a DVD called The Purse and the Sword. It's an 8-hour lecture series on constitutional structure, starting with the Declaration of Independence. All of that is available on Amazon. So if you just type me in there in the book section.
Now, the lectures are called what?
The lecture series is called The Purse and the Sword.
And oh, The Purse and the Sword.
The Declaration
okay.
of Independence ties the Declaration of Independence into the Constitution and then uses those two powers of government as the foils for the discussion. The power of the purse, I focus on the monetary system and now the Federal Reserve, how the power of the purse has gotten out of control of the people
okay.
and into the control of the banks. And then the power of the sword, which ultimately, if you read the Constitution and understand history, this was the militia structure. Right? The people organized.
Okay, now I thought I owned everything, but I don't. I haven't found that, so I'm going to go search that out.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
So there's and then if people want to look on the internet, put my name in on YouTube. There are a number of videos that I did one for a group of House staffers a couple of years ago that dealt with the monetary history of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And tying the Constitution into the various developments or devolutions, if you will, of the monetary and banking system. That was a couple-hour lecture that was presented over there at one of the Rayburn Building. So that's up, and that's a good overview. You can see in a relatively short period of time, takes you through,
okay,
you know, 150 years of American legal and political history.
Have you had any chance to...
There's that kind of material out there, various talks that I've given that people have... That was more professionally done.
Have you, by any chance, seen the documentary Hot Coffee?
No.
It's a documentary by attorney about the process by which tort reform was achieved, and it is one... one way of describing why I'm so concerned about the process at the state level not being a clean one, given the kind of money that is sort of amassed to deal with this. Anyway, I just wanted to ask you that before you close. Okay, well, I just have to tell you, this has been a terrific, terrific discussion, and I think your work and your knowledge is, it's the kind of... protection we need when the wall gets breached. So hopefully we can build this intellectual wall back up to stop us from any kind of foolishness. But I think it's going to be a very interesting year going forward, and I'm very, very glad you're on the planet and we're in cahoots.
Well, thank you, and I agree that I'm very, very glad that you're on the planet. All we can do is keep laying the bricks and see how much reconstruction we can do in the time we have left.
I know. Okay, you have a wonderful day.
Thank you. All right. Bye-bye.